Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. The UN Security Council Friday unanimously adopted a resolution to identify those who have used chlorine and other toxic chemicals in attacks in Syria. From the United Nations, VOA's Margaret Bashir reports that while there is an international organization tasked with establishing whether such weapons have been used, it does not have the authority to say who used them in Syria.
The resolution sets up a team of experts to determine who perpetrated, organized, or sponsored attacks using chlorine and other toxic weapons. Until now, the Global Chemical Weapons Watchdog, known as the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, has only been authorized to determine chemicals were used, but not by whom. In 2013, Syria agreed to declare and have international monitors destroy its chemical weapons stockpile. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon and the OPCW Director General now have 20 days to give the Security Council recommendations for assembling the team. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
U.S. President Barack Obama's effort to sell the Iran nuclear deal to a skeptical Congress has been dealt a serious setback, with one of the president's top allies, Senator Chuck Schumer, coming out against the pact. He said, after deep study, careful thought, and considerable soul-searching, I've decided I must oppose the agreement and will vote yes on a motion of disapproval. Schumer, a senator from the state of New York and one of the top Jewish lawmakers in the U.S., released his statement shortly after another influential Jewish Democrat, Representative Elliot Engel, also from New York State, announced his opposition to the deal. Secretary of State John Kerry said he was profoundly disappointed in the decision. This is VOA News. Billionaire real estate businessman and television personality Donald Trump was center stage Thursday night as 10 leading Republican presidential candidates looked for a breakout moment at their first debate on the road to the November 2016 election. The real estate mogul and nine others squared off in Cleveland, Ohio for the debate that gave Americans their first look at the major Republican candidates 6 months before the first nominating contest in Midwestern state of Ohio. In Mr. Obama's campaign against the Islamic State was the target of the widespread criticism from debaters, many of whom called for the U.S. to utilize combat troops to help defeat the radical extremist group. An enthusiastic crowd of 4,500 people filled the arena cheering on the candidates. A gang of about six men armed with machetes and cleavers hacked a blogger to death in Bangladesh Friday, marking the fourth such murder of a secular writer in the South Asian nation since the beginning of this year. 40-year-old Niloy Chakrabarty, who was known for his atheist views, was killed at his home around noon in the Dhaka neighborhood of Goran. The men entered Niloy's house, pushed aside his wife and a friend, and hacked him to death. Earlier this year, they killed the three secular bloggers on the street, said Imran Sarkar, who leads the blogger and online activist network in Bangladesh. He said this in an interview. Hours later, media outlets received a claim of responsibility for the murder from a group claiming to be the Bangladesh wing of Al-Qaeda in the Indian subcontinent. Suspected Islamist militants have attacked two hotels in central Mali, killing five Malian soldiers and taking a number of hostages. Gamon Kane, governor of the Mopti region, tells VOA French to Africa that the soldiers were killed as gunmen attacked the Debo and Blibos hotels Friday in the town of Sévère. The governor says the Malian army was able to rescue four French hostages, but that one Ukrainian and one South African were still inside the buildings. The Malian army was waiting for a French SWAT team from the capital, Bamako, to arrive and intervene. Pakistan insisted Friday that the Afghan peace and reconciliation process is ongoing and that the death of the leader of Afghanistan's Taliban insurgency, Mullah Omar, has only caused a temporary pause in a policy statement in the National Assembly. The defense minister again dismissed allegations that the reclusive Taliban chief's death occurred in Pakistan. Afghan authorities last week disclosed that Omar died in a hospital in the Pakistani city of Karachi in April of 2013. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Swuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The refugee crisis in Greece is causing unbearable suffering for tens of thousands of people fleeing war, persecution, and human rights violations, according to the UN Refugee Agency. The UNHCR is calling for greater solidarity among European countries to resolve this growing emergency.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from UN Refugee Agency headquarters in Geneva. Details next.
Also, Italian authorities have charged five alleged smugglers with the deaths of an estimated 200 migrants. And a military spokesman says Islamist extremists attacked a hotel in a town in central Mali today.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Rwanda, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the refugee crisis in Greece is causing unbearable suffering for tens of thousands of people fleeing war, persecution, and human rights violations, according to the UN Refugee Agency. The UNHCR is calling for greater solidarity among European countries to resolve this growing emergency. Lisa Schlein reports from agency headquarters in Geneva.
The agency's director for Europe says he saw a situation of total chaos and abandonment on several Greek islands during a recent assessment visit. Vincent Costel says Europe must do more for Greece.
I've been working 30 years with UNHCR. I've visited many African countries, countries in Asia. I've never seen a situation like that. This is European Union, and this is totally shameful. The level of suffering that we have seen on the island was unbearable. What we've seen was not anything that is acceptable in terms of standard of treatment. There is absolutely nothing waiting for them. In terms of water, in terms of sanitation, in terms of food assistance, it's totally inadequate.
The agency reports around 124,000 refugees and migrants have arrived by sea so far this year, mainly to the islands of Lesbos, Chios, Kos, Samos, and Leros. The agency notes this represents an increase of more than 750% compared to the same period last year. In July alone, it says 50,000 people arrived, about 20,000 more than the previous month. Costel says he is tired of seeing the media refer to the refugee crisis as a migrant crisis, saying many are fleeing conflicts in places like Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria. The UNHCR is appealing for an urgent response to the deepening crisis. It says there is no system in place to receive and process the thousands of refugees and migrants arriving on the islands. The agency says Europe must take the lead in providing financial and technical assistance well beyond what it has given so far. It says Greek authorities must coordinate the response and set up an adequate humanitarian assistance mechanism for those who have nothing. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In related news, Italian authorities have charged five alleged smugglers with the deaths of an estimated 200 migrants who presumably drowned in the Mediterranean earlier this week. Some of the 370 survivors of the capsized fishing boat told investigators that the smugglers stabbed and beat some of the migrants and locked them below deck before the 20-meter vessel capsized. The alleged smugglers, who were identified as Libyan and Algerian nationals, were detained when they reached Palermo, Sicily. They disembarked yesterday with many of the survivors aboard the Irish vessel. The five have been charged with multiple homicides and human trafficking. The fishing boat capsized when passengers who saw the naval vessel approaching rushed to one side of the boat, which sank within minutes. Officials estimate there were about 650 migrants packed on the boat.
A military spokesman says Islamist extremists attacked a hotel in a town in central Mali today. Colonel Suleimane Maiga told the AP that troops from a local military base in the town of Savare have exchanged gunfire with jihadists near the Debo Hotel. Other news services also reported one dead after the gunman attacked a second hotel in the town. Savare is about 600 kilometers from Bamako, the capital. UN peacekeepers have a camp in the town, which is 15 kilometers from the historic city of Mopti. Extremists have increased their attacks on government facilities in central and southern Mali since a French-led intervention scattered the militants' forces in 2013.
A new report says efforts to combat LRA rebels in the Democratic Republic of Congo, Central African Republic, and elsewhere have made significant progress since 2010. But it warns the rebels are still trafficking illicit ivory and diamonds and continue to find safe havens. What's more, indicted war crimes leader Joseph Kony remains free. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
5 years ago, President Obama signed the Lord's Resistance Army Disarmament and Northern Uganda Recovery Act. It led the administration to announce a strategy to end the rebels' long reign of killings, abductions, and looting. The AU and UN also launched anti-LRA initiatives. A group called the Resolve LRA Crisis Initiative has released a new report on the progress made, titled The Kony Crossroads, President Obama's chance to define his legacy on the LRA crisis. Paul Ronan is the initiative's director.
For President Obama, his response to the LRA is really one of the keystones to his legacy in Africa. He has really put a lot of time, political energy, and resources into this issue. From the moment that he signed the LRA disarmament bill in May of 2010 and then deployed the U.S. advisors a year later, he has really made it clear that for him, this is an issue that he wants to see done.
Ronan says the number of LRA rebels is down significantly thanks to combined international efforts.
Just a few years ago, Kony, the leader of the LRA, had about 800 combatants at his disposal. And as the result of defection campaigns and operations conducted primarily by the Ugandan military along with the support by the U.S., our best estimates say that he only has about 200 combatants left.
However, Ronan says, while the number of LRA rebels has been reduced, they're still very active.
The LRA has been very successful in poaching endangered elephants in the Democratic Republic of Congo and then taking the illicit ivory up to Sudanese-controlled areas around South Darfur where they sell it in order to get food, other supplies, even arms and ammunition.
Those safe havens in Sudan-controlled South Darfur state are critical for the LRA because U.S. advisors and Ugandan forces are not allowed to operate there. The report also says LRA rebels periodically meet with Seleka rebels and community leaders in eastern CAR to request food and supplies. The Resolve LRA Crisis Initiative director says rebels continue to launch attacks against civilians.
In parts of the Democratic Republic of Congo, LRA attacks and abductions are actually higher than they were even 2 years ago. And the number of displaced people has gone up, and abductions where they're abducting people to take goods back to their camps have really gone up. We've already seen more abductions in the Congo in the first 7 months of 2015 than we did in all of 2013.
The report says that there are gaps in U.S. logistical and intelligence support to U.S. military advisors and their African partners. It says this includes a shortage of airlift support to quickly move troops. The report also says U.S. advisors are rotated out every 6 months, reducing their ability to build a rapport with local communities. Nevertheless, it does praise Operation Observant Compass, which the U.S. launched in 2011. The operation uses radio messages, aerial loudspeakers, and aerial leaflet drops to encourage LRA fighters to surrender. The report says the defection of seven of Kony's bodyguards in June is an example of its effectiveness and should be expanded. The report says President Obama's legacy on the LRA will depend on whether his administration exercises the leadership needed to move beyond mitigation of the crisis towards its definitive resolution. It adds that the President and U.S. Congress deserve credit for reducing the LRA to a shadow of its former self, but they cannot rest until the LRA command structure is dismantled and the group no longer poses a significant threat to civilians. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 16 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. The refugee crisis in Greece is causing unbearable suffering for tens of thousands of people fleeing war, persecution and human rights violations. And a military spokesman says Islamist extremists attacked a hotel in a town in central Mali today. And we'd like your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
The World Health Organization says health workers in Nigeria and Niger have been caught by surprise as a meningitis outbreak sweeps through the region. WHO also reports an acute shortage of the vaccine to fight it. Meningitis is a serious bacterial infection of the thin lining that surrounds the brain and spinal cord. The bacteria can cause severe brain damage and, if untreated, is fatal in 50% of the cases. VOA's David Arnold talked with Dr. William Perrier of of WHO about a critical shortage of the vaccine.
This year, we face one very severe epidemic of meningitis that we call serogroup C, which is a strain that doesn't frequently cause outbreaks in Africa. This serogroup was the cause of a fairly large epidemic in Niger. About 9,000 cases occur, and in Nigeria, about 3,000 cases, for a total of 12,000 cases and around 800 deaths.
I understand the vaccine used for meningitis is in short supply.
Yes, there are two types of vaccines. There are the polysaccharide and the conjugate vaccine. Both are in very, very small quantities. The polysaccharide vaccine is manufactured by only a few vaccine producers. And the conjugate vaccines are unaffordable for populations in Africa.
What are you trying to do now?
So, yes, we're trying to build a stockpile in order to be prepared for the next epidemic season. We think that there's going to be meningitis epidemics in 2016 caused by this new serogroup. And we want to prepare for that, decided to stockpile. So we contacted the manufacturers to get this vaccine, and for a time the answers are negative. For the conjugate vaccine, which is the preferred vaccine because it provides longer immunity and what we call herd immunity as well, and can be used in infants, they said they are not in capacity to scale up or ramp up the production for the next year. And for the polysaccharide vaccine, which is a less interesting vaccine, let's say, because it doesn't have all the characteristics I just mentioned of the conjugate vaccine, they have offered just a few number.
What do you expect will happen?
From the conjugate vaccine, the perspectives are nil. The manufacturers answer very strongly that they don't have vaccine, that they won't be able to offer any vaccine for us. Basically, this vaccine has a market in the Western countries and is sold at prices that can go between $30 to $70. As far as polysaccharide vaccine, we have some offers of some millions of doses, but obviously, if an epidemic strikes in a place like Burkina Faso or in Nigeria, where explosive epidemics can occur, a couple of million of doses won't be enough to respond appropriately. The consequence of that is that they will spread quicker, and that may cause a lot of suffering and death.
That was Dr. William Perrier of the WHO in Geneva talking to VOA's David Arnold in Washington, D.C.
Several journalists working for Afrique Media, one of Africa's biggest television channels, have gone into hiding after Cameroon police stormed their offices in Yaoundé and ordered them to stop broadcasting. Cameroon's National Communication Council says it gave the order because Afrique Media has repeatedly failed to respect ethics. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Peter Issoka, acting president of Cameroon's National Communication Council, NCC, says Afrique Media defied a one-month suspension it was given in June of this year and continued broadcasting. He says two journalists working for the media company also did not respect a six-month suspension they were given for what officials say was repeated professional misconduct.
The divisional officer for Yaoundé 2 and a number of officials of law and order went to that media house and sealed it. But as we hear with the latest information was that they are still broadcasting, but it's the responsibility of the divisional officer or the administration to follow up on the measures they've taken.
The Communication Council also accused Afrique Media of making unjustifiable accusations likely to impair the image and honor of personalities, institutions, and foreign countries. Kininsom of the Cameroon Association of English-Speaking Journalists says the channel should have respected the suspension order.
When we talk about the press, we should also talk about ethics. If we pretend that we are free with the violation of ethics that we are seeing, one day get up and discover that the journalism that we're claiming to be protecting is no longer there. How free is the journalist who has just walked into the profession without even trying to see what the ABC of journalism is all about?
Manyi Tada Juliana and Muhammad Bashir Ladan, the two journalists who were suspended, and their colleagues have not been seen since the police sealed their office. But the channel, headquartered in Malabo, Equatorial Guinea, has continued broadcasting. Last year, Reporters Without Borders said the very high number of summonses and suspensions handed out in Cameroon was an indication the NCC had taken a tough line towards journalists. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Thank you, Moke. In Zimbabwe, it's been a month since an American dentist killed an iconic lion named Cecil, an incident which attracted media attention worldwide. Sebastian Mofu has been to the Hwange area where Cecil was killed and asked the question, how important was this lion to Zimbabweans?
Most locals spoken to in this wildlife-rich area of Hwange, about 700 kilometers southwest of Harare, say the media and activists have gone into the overdrive. This lady in her late 30s asked to be identified only as Zah, fearing she would antagonize Zimbabwean authorities who have asked for the extradition of Walter Palmer, an American dentist who shot the lion with a bow and arrow. Her father, she said, has lost more than 10 cattle to lions over the years. Thus, she feels there's no need to mourn the loss of Cecil.
I think what might grieve us as a community is to hear how much this lion was worth and to think that as communities, these animals are worth this much, but we don't benefit anything from having them here.
Across the river lives Nora Swanda.
I think it's rubbish because most Zimbabweans doesn't know about Cecil, so I don't see the fuss about Cecil.
This woman, who also refused to be identified, said attention should be focused on the millions of Zimbabweans who are suffering, not lions.
It's got a lot of publicity, but what about the hundreds and thousands of people in need and starving?
At least one person, Rob Jobson, an Australian tourist visiting Hwange, said he had been touched by the killing of Cecil the lion.
Quite apart from it being a disgraceful act of conservation vandalism, I also believe that it's against the laws of this country And I would like to see the authorities in this country deal with all concerned according to law as they deserve.
Palma has gone into hiding in the U.S. as activists demand that he face charges for Sisu's death. As of Friday, more than 230,000 people had signed a petition calling on the Obama administration to extradite Palma. Meanwhile, the trial of a Zimbabwean hunter accused of helping Palma kill Sisu is set to start next month. Theo Dobrongost faces up to 10 years in prison if convicted. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Wange, Zimbabwe.
Well, Nigeria has the world's second largest film industry in terms of the number of films produced, trailing India's Bollywood and ahead of Hollywood. The Nigerian industry, collectively called Nollywood, is just starting to have an impact internationally. And as Michael Sullivan tells us, some Nollywood producers got some tips on marketing on a recent visit to Los Angeles.
120 knots.
The 2012 film Last Flight to Abuja from director Obi Ebolonia was a disaster thriller based on the true tale of an air crash. 30 Days in Atlanta from Nigerian comic Ayo Makun was the top earning Nigerian feature ever. It chronicles the adventures of a Nigerian man and his cousin on a month-long trip to America. Cinema professors and movie professionals recently met with 30 Nigerian producers at the UCLA Film School, where the Nollywood movie makers, including Fidelis Duker, heard tips on promoting their burgeoning industry.
If an industry that employs close to a million people, either directly or indirectly, and has close to about $500 million in revenue annually,
it could have billions in revenue if not for piracy. Pirated DVDs are sold openly in markets, and the Nigerian government has promised to crack down. Nigeria produces more than 1,000 feature films each year. Most are quickly shot on inexpensive digital equipment. They are typically direct-to-DVD, with low budgets and the tens of thousands of dollars. Major Hollywood movies can cost $200 million or more. In 2 weeks of seminars at the UCLA Film School, these producers heard about the art and business of movie making. Hollywood actress Diane Ladd, a three-time Oscar nominee, spoke about the importance of collaboration.
When we in the arts work together, we're promoting culture. And remember, if a civilization loses its culture, you lose the civilization.
The 2012 film, Half of a Yellow Sun, starring the British actor Chiwetel Ejiofor, was an adaptation of an award-winning African novel set against the backdrop of the Biafra Civil War in Nigeria of the 1960s. Nigerian producers say there are more like these to come. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Hiswu Hib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Happening Africa. This is Jackson Bungani in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 1730 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am
am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The refugee crisis in Greece is causing unbearable suffering for tens of thousands of people fleeing war, persecution, and human rights violations. And a military spokesman says Islamist extremists attacked a hotel in a town in central Mali today. Coming up, we'll have music from Rwanda and our feature reports. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Spuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. And it's time now for the sunny side of sports with Jonah Haskell sitting in this week for Sonny Young. And happy Friday, Jonah.
Happy Friday, Kim.
What's on tap today?
Well, we begin today in Kazan, Russia, where the World Aquatic Championships are underway. Thursday was a busy day in the central Russian city as five finals took place on the competition's third to last day. The highly anticipated men's 100-meter freestyle final featured a photo finish as China's Ning Shidao, Australia's Cameron McAvoy, and Argentina's Federico Grabich all finished within 0.3 seconds of each other. Although McAvoy had the best time in the semifinals, he had to settle for silver as Shidao claimed yet another gold medal for China. Grabich came in third to earn the bronze, the first medal ever awarded to an Argentinian swimmer at the World Aquatic Championships. The men's 200-meter individual medley had no surprises, as American Ryan Lochte, who is the world record holder in the event, won his record fourth consecutive IM gold and 24th medal overall at the Worlds. After the race, Lochte spoke about which of those medal wins was the most memorable.
It would have to be a toss-up between this one that I did tonight, just because I made history. I think that's the coolest thing when you can say that you've done that in any kind of sport. Or 2011 when I broke the world record. It's definitely something that I'll remember for the rest of my life.
Thiago Pereira of Brazil came in second, while Wang Shun of China took the bronze. The women's 200-meter butterfly event was anything but close, as Japan's Natsumi Hoshi touched the wall almost a full second before silver medalist Camille Adams. It is Japan's first gold medal in Kazan and the first victory for a Japanese female at any swimming race in World Aquatics Championship history. Zhang Yufei of China came in third, and although her time was only good enough for bronze, Yufei, who is only 17, set a new junior world record, beating her own mark set earlier this month. The women's 50-meter backstroke yielded two more medals for the Chinese, as Fu Yuanhui took the gold and Liu Xiang settled for bronze. Finishing 0.15 seconds behind Yuanhui was Brazilian Etienne Medeiros, who earned silver. And finally, in the women's 4x200-meter freestyle relay, the United States were powered to a win by phenom Katie Ledecky, who has already won three golds and broken a world record in Kazan. Along with her teammates Missy Franklin, Leah Smith, and Katie McLaughlin, Katie and the United States cruised to a win by almost 3 seconds over the second-place Italians. After the race, Katie McLaughlin and Katie Ledecky both spoke about how their teams gave them motivation.
Not particularly. I knew if I was within striking distance that I could bring it home and tough it out. But honestly, Katie McLaughlin had the best last 50 out there, and I'm so proud of her, what she's done this week. She's had a tremendous week and has really done a lot for our team.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, definitely having my teammates, too, on my relay definitely gave me a little strength at the end when I started to feel tired. I just want to do it for the team and for USA, so...
The Chinese women took the bronze in that race. And that brings us now to the medal count, where China still has a commanding lead with 32 medals overall and 14 golds. The Chinese have 5 more golds than the closest challenger and 12 more medals overall. The second place country is the United States, who used a strong day on Thursday to pass Russia in the standings. The U.S. now has 20 total medals and 9 gold ones. Russia, in third, has the same number of gold medals as the U.S., but fewer overall, with just 15. The World Aquatics Championships finish this Sunday, August 9th. Kick it!
Sunnysada Sports welcomes your comments. You can send me email at sunny@voanews.com. Sunny is spelled S-O-N-N-Y. And pick up a pen or a pencil and a piece of paper. My full postal mailing address is The Sunnysada Sports, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue Southwest, room 1613, Washington, D.C., 20237.
The VOA's Daybreak Africa sportsman Marco Ouma joins us now from Johannesburg, South Africa, and I believe he's tipping off with basketball.
Host Mali dismissed Morocco 76-34 in quarterfinal action at the Africa Boys Under-16 Basketball Championships in Bamako on Thursday night. Angola outplayed Nigeria 79-48, Egypt breezed past Tunisia 93-85, and Algeria outplayed South Africa 62-41. Today, Friday, in semifinal action, Mali play Algeria as Angola encounter Egypt. In classification matches, Morocco play South Africa as Nigeria encounter Tunisia. In rugby, Namibia host Kenya in a Confederation of African Rugby Division 1 a tie in Fintook tomorrow Saturday. Turning to football, African champions Mali are drawn with Belgium, Ecuador and Honduras in Group D preliminaries at the Boys' 2015 FIFA Under-17 World Cup. According to the draws conducted in Santiago, Chile on Thursday night, Nigeria is in Group A with Croatia, the United States of America and hosts Chile. Guinea is in Group B with Brazil, England and South Korea. South Africa is in Group E where they face Costa Rica, North Korea and Russia. In Switzerland, Mauritania is Africa's most improved men's national football team, while Benin has slipped by the widest margin according to the FIFA rankings released in Zurich on Thursday. Placed 19th, Algeria's Desert Fox are Africa's highest-ranked team. African champions Ivory Coast are 21st, Ghana 27th, Tunisia 34th, Senegal 39th, Cameroon 42nd, Republic of Congo 43rd, Cape Verde Islands 50th, Egypt 52nd, and Nigeria 53rd. Meanwhile, in an all-Algerian encounter, Mouloudia El Ulma host USM Algiers in El Ulma, as Sudan's El Hilal welcome Morocco's Maghreb Tetouan in Omdurman in mini-league action in the Orange Africa Champions League today, Friday. Tomorrow, Saturday, the Democratic Republic of Congo's TP Mazembe host Egypt's Smuha in Lubumbashi as Sudan's El Merrek host Algeria's defending champions Intensitif in Khartoum on Sunday. Elsewhere, South Africa's Orlando Pirates welcome Tunisia's CS Faxin to Soweto as Tunisia's Etoile du Sahel host Egyptian defending champions El Ahly in Sousse in mini-league action in the Orange Africa Confederations Cup tomorrow, Saturday. On Sunday, Republic of Congo's AC Leopards are at home to Egypt's Zamalek in Dolesi as Mali's Stade Malien hosts Tunisia's Esperance in Bamako.
Thank you, Mark. The 2015-2016 English Premier League season kicks off Saturday with 6 games. Louis van Gaal's Manchester United will open the season against last year's fifth-place finisher Tottenham Hotspur early on Saturday afternoon. And later on Saturday night, Eden Hazard and last year's champions Chelsea will begin their title defense against Swansea City. Chelsea's manager Jose Mourinho spoke recently about his team's readiness for the upcoming season.
No, we are where we can be. We have the same team, we have the same players. We had a good holiday because I thought a good holiday is important for the future of these players during a long season they have in front of them. We decided for a short preseason, shorter than many other teams. So, you know, we are where we are, and Wednesday we have another match to play and for other players to get more minutes, and we will try to be in conditions to start.
We'll see if that idea of taking a short preseason works out. On Sunday, Christian Benteke and Liverpool will begin their campaign at Stoke City, while a newly repowered Arsenal will take on West Ham United. And finally, on Monday, Yaya Toure and Manchester City look to begin their season on a good note against West Brom. At a press conference on Friday, City boss Manuel Pellegrini set the bar very high for his star-studded team.
Well, it's always for me a good season in a big team is that you must win a title. You cannot say that it was a very good season and you didn't win then nothing about it. But after that, I think also it's very important the way you win that title. Maybe for some reason you can win the title, and if I'm not happy in the way we play, for me, no, it's not a good season. That's why I repeat, for me, both things. First of all, win, because you must win titles. And the second thing is to play in the way I like this team must play.
Last year, Manchester City finished second after a frustrating season of chasing Chelsea at the top of the table. If you'd like more information on the upcoming Premier League season, the majority of today's 30-minute extended edition of Sunnyside of Sports is for you. I sit down with VOA's resident football buffs Downtown Brown and Tef to discuss some of the big stories in English football this season. You can catch that at 17:30 UTC on The Voice of America.
This kid fights great. He's got speed and endurance. But if you sign to fight him, increase your insurance. I am the greatest.
Friends, we can all listen to The Sunny Side of Sports.
Yes, my friend.
The Sunny Side of Sports.
Sunny Side of Sports.
The Sunny Side of Sports Show.
Great show, bro. This is Sunny Side of Sports.
Sunny Side of Sports right here on The Voice of America.
Voice of America.
Stand up. Stand up. Stand up. Stand up.
Next weekend, Jordan Spieth and the rest of professional golf's elite will be in Kohler, Wisconsin, in the northern central USA, for the final golf major of the year, the PGA Championship. Right now, though, the top golfers in the world are focusing on the WGC Bridgestone Invitational, which is currently in its second round. The current leaders are American Jim Furyk and Graham McDowell of Northern Ireland, both at 4-under. 22 other golfers are within three shots of the lead, including world number two Jordan Spieth and British Open champion Zach Johnson. The African highest on the leaderboard is South African Carl Schwartzel, who is currently even. The next two rounds of the WGC Bridgestone Invitational will be played this weekend, and the PGA Championship will begin next Thursday, August 13th. And that does it for today's edition of The Sunny Side of Sports. I'm VOA's Jonah Haskell. Back to Kim Lewis and Yahias Wuhib.
Thank you, Jonah. And listen to The Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of The Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 hours UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Coming up, Kenya, an important battlefield in the war against organized wildlife poaching. And next, creation of small business in Africa. But first, some music. Here is Martin Martin of Rwanda with Yoba Yoba.
Yoba Yoba, Yoba Yoba, Yoba Yoba, mwana wa mama tuwe mmoja. Yoba Yoba, Yoba Yoba. Yoba yoba mwana wa mama tuwe mmoja.
Yoba.
Sogokura jagusinzira. Yara tu
dufite turabuzukuru batatu twibera mu mataba twiragira inka z'iwacu akadukamira yera tukanywa tukanyurwa tukitetera umukuru muri twe akaba intajorwa umukurikiye akaba intarumikwa nanjye umuto muri bo maze kuba umugabo udaterwa nk'undi mwana waje nge Tangira kuryana byato nato bazutubonye bikamurenga bikamuyobera bikamushobera sogokuru yaje kuducira umugani nako n'umufindo mbambaroga afata inkoni eshatu arazibangikanya azibohesha umurungu ukomeye ati bana banjye mubaze kuba abagabo ngaho nimuvunaguriza inkoni ndeba bana banjye uburiza muri twe arazizingira zimunaniya zikikiriza ubuheta nanjye uyeture nizana nkwereke ahari aho dufatanije twazivunagura inkoni zitubera ibamba ziratunanira azifata azikuraho wa murunga arazikonyagura imwe ku yindi tukwaratugira tumumaze kubona abana banjye nimuguma hamwe ntawe uzabatera nimuguma kuryana bazabavunagura nk'izi nkoni
Manny Martin of Rwanda with Yoba Yoba.
Kenya is an important battlefield in the war against organized wildlife poaching. The U.S. is stepping up its global efforts by working with key countries and providing them with more law enforcement and high-tech tools. John Walker reports.
A situation room of sorts on wildlife poaching, a review of the wins, the losses, and where to go next. Conflict, poaching, and a seemingly insatiable thirst for ivory. The experts agree time is running out for Africa's elephants.
And so it was these data sets that were pulled together that actually showed us what was going on the ground. And next slide, it showed that we actually had a 76% decline in elephant populations over the last decade.
While public education campaigns have reduced ivory demand, especially in China and Southeast Asia, poaching remains a cash maker for terror groups operating in Africa. U.S. Representative Ed Royce is chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee and a sponsor of the Global Anti-Poaching Act.
We're what put that heavy price, you know, the purchase of these products, that put the profits into the hands of who? Into groups like the Lord's Resistance Army, into terrorist networks that are now stretching across Africa, like Al-Shabaab. And so we need new tools.
Journalist Brian Christie's investigations for National Geographic magazine help expose the horrors of poaching and the human costs involved.
Yeah, the chairman's legislation is really extraordinary. It's taking what people have been talking about for quite some time, taking wildlife crime, and elevating it to the sorts of crime that we abhor generally, human trafficking, drug trafficking. It's on par with that. It's really a fantastic step forward.
All of this is taking place at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. The center brings together experts to share knowledge and advise policymakers. Dan Ash is the director of U.S. Fish and Wildlife. After a recent trip to Tanzania, he decided to put more resources on the front lines.
So what we're doing worldwide is we're putting law enforcement liaisons, our special agents, our undercover investigative agents, into U.S. embassies across the world. So by the end of this year, we'll have agents in China, in Vietnam, in Tanzania, in Botswana, and in Lima, Peru, to work with wildlife enforcement networks across the world and target our law enforcement efforts.
And in Kenya, local leaders are developing programs to lift villagers out of poverty so they can resist the easy money offered by poachers.
One of the reasons we came here was to discuss poaching and anti-poaching and security in Africa. And my part of the world is true, is prone to poaching. Luckily, the communities that live immediately next to these parks are not by nature poachers, they are pastoralists. And we are trying our best since we came in as a county government to improve their ways of life, give them necessary infrastructure, look at their health, education for their children, look for some employment for them, and also make them feel that this wildlife is there for them.
How do you make a live rhino worth more than a dead rhino? Think big.
U.S. officials say nearly half of all jobs created in Africa are from small businesses, many of them by women. Arupande speaks to one Rwandan handicrafts exporter who has transformed the lives of thousands of women with the help of the United States.
The Rwandan genocide decimated families and left many women to fend for themselves. But Janet Nakubana and her sister devised a way to help Rwandan women become self-reliant. They sell their hand-woven baskets overseas to large U.S. retailers like Macy's through our handicraft export company, Gahaya Links.
We have actually empowered over 3,000 women in Rwandan communities. These women are no longer on the street begging. They can buy their health insurance. They can pay tuition for their children.
Nakubana credits the 2000 African Growth and Opportunity Act for opening U.S. markets to African entrepreneurs like her, and the government-funded U.S. Africa Development Foundation for giving her a grant and the training needed to get her business off the ground a decade ago. USADF Chairman Jack Leslie says the foundation's mission is to work with the underserved in Africa, where small business creates about 50% of the jobs on the continent.
Africa, to give you a sense, only gets about 3% of foreign direct investment. So helping these engines of growth and these enterprises that are really creating jobs is incredibly important, and they're good investments.
Leslie says President Obama's visit to Kenya and speech at the Global Entrepreneurship Summit will bring the world's attention to a new wave of economic activity in Africa.
There's talk of the Silicon Savannah in East Africa, which is really showing amazing leaps in mobile technology. I mean, in many ways, the Kenyans are way ahead of us in the United States on mobile banking, for example.
But it's not just boosting small African entrepreneurs. USADF is also pairing with large American companies like GE to help give more Africans access to electricity. GE Africa CEO Jay Ireland says Africa offers tremendous potential for investment, but adequate infrastructure is key to economic growth.
The economic growth of the countries are going to be absolutely critical to have power. And they need that to attract manufacturing. They need that to whether it's mines or oil rigs or shopping centers or whatever, they need electricity. So you're looking at a significant deficit of power across the range of countries.
GE, USADF, and others are supporting small businesses to come up with off-grid energy solutions. For Janet Nakubana, investing in entrepreneurs, particularly women, is key to the economic empowerment of an entire country.
Empowering us, giving us opportunities, you are giving opportunity to the generation of tomorrow.
Aru Pandey, VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Jackson Mvunganyi, and our engineer, Shaogun Chung, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In September, the U.S. Congress will vote on whether or not to disapprove the comprehensive nuclear accord agreed to last month by the P5 plus one countries and Iran. In a speech in Washington defending the deal, President Barack Obama was blunt.
The choice we face is ultimately between diplomacy or some form of war. Maybe not tomorrow, maybe not 3 months from now, but soon.
Mr. Obama added that, ironically, military action would be far less effective than this deal in preventing Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon.
Every estimate, including those from Israeli analysts, suggest military action would only set back Iran's program by a few years at best, which is a fraction of the limitations imposed by this deal.
Mr. Obama called the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA, the strongest nonproliferation agreement ever negotiated, permanently prohibiting Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon by verifiably cutting off all Iran's pathways to a bomb, thereby securing one of the U.S.'s critical security objectives by means of hard, painstaking diplomacy. President Obama noted that all problems with Iran are not solved by the nuclear accord.
The ruling regime is dangerous and it is repressive. We will continue to have sanctions in place on Iran's support for terrorism and violation of human rights. We will continue to insist upon the release of Americans detained unjustly.
Mr. Obama decried the rhetoric and behavior emanating from some parts of Iran, calling it offensive and incendiary. But he said that superpowers should not act impulsively in response to taunts or even provocations that can be addressed short of war. Just because Iranian hardliners chant death to America, he said, does not mean that's what all Iranians believe.
The majority of the Iranian people have powerful incentives to urge their government to move in a different, less provocative direction. Incentives that are strengthened by this deal. We should offer them that chance. We should give them that opportunity.
It's not guaranteed to succeed, said President Obama. But if they take it, that would be good for Iran. It would be good for the United States. It would be good for a region that has known too much conflict. It would be good for the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
Feast with your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This one, this one,
every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel.